Backyard Green Films is proud to present this episode of Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Alara and her husband, Rick, travel throughout the land in their travel trailer, which they have nicknamed Bessie, bringing you stories about their travels and the people they meet. They visit farmers, ranchers, and just about anyone who loves putting their hands in the dirt or their feet in stirrups. In those travels, they have gotten to meet some very interesting people.
Hi, this is Alara. Welcome back to our podcast. Believe it or not, we're starting the sixth year of the Agriculture Podcast here at the Backyard Green Film Studio. We thank all of you for sticking with us for half a decade now. We'd also like to send out a special thanks to our Patreon and other sponsors who help us with financial support. You are helping us to make a difference, and we couldn't do it without you. We're changing our format around a little bit this year. You'll still get an introduction to our podcast guests, but the rumination part you usually hear is going where it just might deserve to go, as an episode unto itself, on the back end. We're calling it Ruminations from the Field, because rumination is what happens after ingestion, after all. And yes, my ego understands the implications and agrees. In any case, we'd love to have you check it out and enjoy that part of our podcast as well. We'd like to remind everyone that our Backyard Green Films YouTube channel has much of the visual content that goes with the interviews we bring you here at the podcast, and more. And remember, you can always find us on social media in whichever portal you favor. Well, here's to today. Thanks for coming along for the ride. Today, we're going to bring you a conversation with a guy who raises Devon cattle, Coopworth sheep, pigs, turkeys, and more than a few chickens. His name is Steve Montgomery, and he and his family run Lamppost Farm in Columbiana, Ohio. Lamppost is a place intended to build connections, educate new agriculturalists, and to foster healthy relationships. Basically, this is a family that always has a space at the kitchen table for one more, and it's a place where you know your kids will be somewhere that they know that they matter. They might learn a little bit, too, while they learn not to be scared of getting manure on their boots. Here's Steve.
I'm Steve Montgomery from Lamppost Farm. I'm the executive director here.
Yeah, and you have quite a menagerie here. I love the fact that you have dogs here, and I know we were talking about that, so we might get a little bit of activity here, we know, but this is sort of one of the things that happens on a farm, right? You have cattle dogs, and they do a little cattling and a little visiting in the house. And
yes, they're mostly social.
Well, that's a good thing, because you have quite a few people here on this farm. Tell me a little bit about Lamppost, where we are, this region of the country, and sort of why you started in farming.
Sure. We're in Columbiana, Ohio. Lamppost Farm is a nonprofit organization that we started back in 2007, mostly in response to my dad being diagnosed and then passing away with colon cancer. And it sent us on a journey just to ask the question about why is our food system so void of nutrition? And so my wife and I started doing a lot of research with some friends and figured that the crossroads of our lives intersected in using agriculture as education and ministry. It's what I had been doing in campus ministry prior, using adventure education, taking students on backpacking trips. So we wanted to set up a farm that was similar to that, that would be experiential by design. And so we just started to learn how to do agriculture. We processed chickens with people and had a book about how to do that along the way, and then started to wade into the cattle world and discovered Devon cattle, and that's why we went that direction. That story can unfold a long way, if you want.
Well, there are probably about 15 things I'd add to that. I had parents that both passed away from metastatic cancer, and it does, you know, when you do have time to think about all this, even when you don't, but particularly when you do, you really think about what you want in life and how much you want to make the world a better place and what your role in it, all of those things that really definitely come to mind. Now, farming is particularly one of those things that will bring you back to the earth, because there's a lot of reality in it, especially when you raise chickens and
right.
You might get the eggs, but you might also have chicken dinner. It does bring you back to the very basic things in life. Mm-hmm. And people are detached from that in many circumstances. So tell me about the types of things that people learn when they're here, about realities of farming.
Yeah, so just, I mean, in some ways it's pace. We're in such a hurried world that we don't take the time to stop and even learn and experience kind of how things grow. You know, we hear stories from, in my world, from like scripture about, you know, Abraham feeding, you know, the angel of the Lord, and we just read past that. But we, when you look into it and how long it took, he went out and killed a calf and brought it in and roasted it and made soup out of it and made 80 loaves of bread, had, you know, his whole family working on this meal. That would have taken almost a full day to do. And so pace is one of those elements of, like, when people come here, they start to realize, like, I didn't know what went into the meal that I end up sitting down and not even really thinking twice about. Now I do. And they see it, and it kind of opens their eyes to, oh, this is what goes into all the backstory behind providing life and sustenance for us. And then when you realize the shortcuts we've taken in our world and how that has consequences all the way down to parents having cancer that, you know, they can't recover from, and the losses we all feel, you go, we've made choices along the way that probably shouldn't have. And our farm is designed to be a place to kind of just look behind the curtain and see what it takes to engage the world in a way that we're in relationship to it. You know, not that we take from it and we're demanding of it. We relate to it in a way that we give and it gives back. And that's why we do what we do.
Yeah, I think it's very important for people to understand the cost of things. And by cost, that's not always just a financial thing.
Right.
There is a cost, whether it's effort or labor or, you know, for whatever it happens to be. Our food production is the one thing we really cannot do without. And investiture in it by the people that decide to invest in it is a really important thing. But in some cases in this world where things have become mass-produced and easier, not that that's not important to feed everybody, I think if we want variety in life, or, you know, variety is the first thing that comes to mind. But the actuality is, it takes something to get here. Mm-hmm. And I look at the dairy farms that we're losing. If you do not invest in those things that have a cost, people that are trying to keep that way of life going, you're only going to have one choice, right? You're going to have one dairy farm.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And the reality is that people are making that decision of, the low cost is more important to me than paying a couple of dollars extra to support the guy that's going to give me that choice, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you find that it's really important to start at a young age with kids? Because you have mostly kids here, is that right?
No, or
is that
our everybody? Target is, we did campus ministry for 15 years. And so our target was initially just college students. And what we realize is we're actually more in relationship with families, the people who make decisions about what to eat and how. And I mean, we'll have youth groups come through, and college student groups still. But, I mean, our store is open one day a week, and it's families. It's husbands and wives or individuals that come that are, you know, concerned about the environment that their animals are raised in, the way animals are raised, the health of the food they're eating, how it's slaughtered. I mean, there's a myriad of reasons why people come, but it's mostly young adults or older adults. And we like that, actually.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Join us each week on the Well Beyond Medicine podcast as we explore the 80% of child health impacts that occur outside the doctor's office. Listen and subscribe at nemourswellbeyond.org, where you'll hear pediatric experts, researchers, and policymakers from around the world discussing ways they are revolutionizing children's health. I'm your host, Carol Vassar. Let's go.
Let's go. Medicine.
So tell me a little bit. Have you, you've been in this for how long? Tell me how you got into the farming.
Yeah. How did we get into farming? What's the short story of that?
Is there ever a short story of that?
No, there's not a short story of that. We, farming doesn't lie to you. Like we, when we started to realize what it, you know, what was, what happened on a farm, we were like, this is a great context for education because it's thin. You don't have to, you don't have to go through a lot of layers to understand what's happening in me, what's happening in the world, in the people around me. So it was just like adventure education and taking people to the wilderness to have experiences that they could learn from. Farming was that. It was the wilderness, but home. Like it was a lifestyle of being in the wilderness. And so we started to realize, like, when you put animals in places where they do what they do best, they come alive and they flourish. And that's the relationships in the whole world all around us. When plants and people and you know, cities and rural start to work well, being what they are, that there's a flourishing that happens. The problem is that's not often considered, right? So we put animals in houses to raise them because that's more efficient. We put animals on feedlots or cattle on feedlots and feed. We bring feed to them, which is not what they're designed to do. They're designed to move and walk and eat. And anyway, and so you, once they started to be in that space like that, in a space like that where we could see them be what they were, like dogs, created to be. That was once we realized that, like, the majority of the animals raised in North America, in the United States, are not, they don't live the lives they were created to live. So they were just, so a cow isn't a grass-eating, you know, manure-producing, fertility-giving animal. They're basically just a beef cut. So we started to realize, like, we want those animals to do what they do, and the byproducts we get to consume as well. They give themselves to us as well. And once we started going, huh, that's we want to try to figure out how to capture that as an expression and invite people to see that. So that's why we moved to agriculture away from campus ministry. How we actually got here is we came to Ohio to be part of a church community, and we're given the opportunity to land in this space and to start learning how to farm. And we've just learned over the 16 years, failing forward over and over, and kind of grew, you know, put fences in and understood animals differently and had lots of great mentors along the way.
It's always interesting to me that, you know, you may have come here because there was a church community. Somebody may have come here because they had a life event that was traumatic.
Right.
And by here, I mean into the farming space. But we all have commonalities regardless of why we do it. There's something primal and basic and grounding about being near animals. I know you were talking about the relatability. We spoke with a gal at Lunan Bay Farms in Scotland. She was using the goats in the school system to kind of teach kids, using them in an educational concept. And it wasn't just teaching them about goats. It was teaching them about math and counting and the nitrogen cycle.
Right.
You know, all of these things they can learn, but in a very approachable space. It's that, you know, the osmosis, it kind of slides over into something. So it doesn't feel so much like you're in a structured learning thing.
Right.
And you connect with it.
Right.
So, but it doesn't matter where you come from or the reason you got into it, everybody connects.
Sure.
Isn't that an amazing thing?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about, there's a school right down the road here that you can, it's across the road from our one pasture. And we don't teach kids how to play. They play just naturally. They want to relate to one another. And they'll run around, and you'll see kids like hiding behind things and, you know, covering their eyes and playing hide and seek, whatever. Like, nobody had to say, go, this is how you play hide and seek, go do it. They just figured it out. And there's a kind of a primal want to connect that we all have. And we see that here. People come to the farm with this idea that they, you know, they're going to come and see animals. And all of a sudden the world opens up to them. And now they see the people around them, the people of their community, the food on their plate. The world just opens up. And to me, that's just good learning and good education, you know.
Now, this sort of brings me into the name of your farm. I grew up with C.S. Lewis books. C.S. Yes. Lewis, correct? So yeah. The lamppost for everybody that maybe watched the film, maybe that's where they got their connection from, is the story of these kids in England that went through a wardrobe and found a whole new world. They came out of the wardrobe, and it's this little magic moment. And it is sort of an allegory. It's a tale that I know C.S. Lewis had a connection there to kind of connect kids with biblical stories. It's right. Very obvious that sure. is the case. But it's also, even if you're non-biblical, it's a really great moment to say there's this guidepost somewhere, right. And a thing that looks like a closed door. You go through it, and there's this whole world and stories in it. So, was that what drew you to the name? Is that why you named the farm?
Absolutely,
after that?
Yeah. So, I grew up with my dad reading me the Chronicles of Narnia, and my brothers as well. It was just a family thing. So, with a love for the Chronicles of Narnia. So, when I had kids, we started doing that, and you know. Imagination is tied directly to hope of new world and new ways of thinking and doing. And so, yeah, when we started tying, you know, these kids and the adventure in a new world, like at a lamppost where they meet a half man, half goat named Tumnus that talks, carrying an umbrella and books, like there's all kinds of imagination that happens. C.S. Lewis was amazing at creating a story that opened our eyes to see things. Many people are. But that actually, so that ties in, I think, to what the conversation's been, that people long for something they don't have, that they want a better, you know? They want to relate and they want to be known, and they want to know differently. And that's, I think, what the lamppost signifies for us, is it's a place to enter a new world and to see this is different than what it was like for me back home, you know? Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm kind of a sci-fi geek. I mean, I love reading new stories and new tales. But that seems like what you're doing here, right? I mean, you're introducing kids to things, and families, older adults, to things that they might not quite understand yet because they get their milk from a case in a store, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one of the big questions we're asked regularly is, why do the cows have horns and the bulls not? Well, that's genetics, you know, and it's like hair color. But most people grow up thinking bulls have horns and cows don't, because pictures, you know. And so we're just kind of taking, it's paradigm shifts, giving opportunity for people to go tilt their head a little bit and go, oh, that's different than I thought it was. And you know, carrots are not just orange. Some of them are purple and some of them are yellow. And those are the flavor when they're harvested in the winter is different than when they're harvested in the summer. And so giving them experiences along the way like that, you know, how's honey produced or maple syrup, and who discovered that maple sap coming out of a tree is sweet and can be cooked down to make syrup, and how good that is, you know?
Yeah, you were telling you're giving the example of the biblical sheep and the meal. It's interesting to me that every religion on the planet, it seems, and the non-religions too, have food as the basis of their connectivity.
Right. Well, you know, in the biblical story, you have Adam and Eve, and sin is entered through the eating of an apple.
Yeah, that is very much food oriented.
And Jesus says, "Remember me through the eating of bread and the drinking of wine." Like, there's an intimacy that we have whenever we take food into our body, that we're connected to something and someone somewhere, whether it's animals or farmers that harvest the grapes, or people that made the bread, or that's not by accident that food is at the center of most expressions. And most peace deals around the world through history have happened around tables.
Breaking bread.
Eating food together.
Yeah. Right. If you look at Judaism, Passover, and you appreciate the food either when you're abstaining from it, so you realize the value of it, and then again when you come to the end and you go to eat again, you have that celebration. But every single faith or non-faith or family has food at the center of it, right? You need an attorney once a year and a doctor once a month, but you need a farmer every day. And we take it for granted because it becomes common and sort of it's just that thing that you get. But we really do need to center ourselves and realize the value of the thing, I think.
Right.
Yeah. So now I'm going to go back to something that, because you mentioned the horns. And that's one of those kind of funny things because you are in the Devon universe. You have Red Devons, right?
Right.
The beef Devons, so people might know. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that determines what many beef breeders might say is they're polled animals oftentimes. But the origin of the breed, the original milking Devons did have horns. So this is kind of an interesting, there was an interesting little moment where the breeders split and some decided to go with that original milking Devon that had certain characteristics and they kind of branched off. At least to my understanding, they kind of branched off and went to the beefier side of things. So, but either way, there's some characteristics that seem to hold true. Tell me how the temperament of Devons, milking or beef, and that docile temperament, if you've experienced that, really contributes to how they fit into place on this piece of property in this lamppost farm.
Well, because we're a nonprofit organization and we want people to do more than just watch at a distance, we want people to enter into that space. I needed to have animals that I could trust that weren't going to just be crazy and run over people. There are strangers that enter our pastures on a regular basis, and our cattle just look up and keep chewing their cud, you know? I mean, they're excited. Obviously, you can't run among the animals, and you can't, you have to understand how that process is educational, too. Like, animals aren't just standing there. They have a flight zone and they'll walk away. But with Devons, they're very approachable. We can gather them up in a corral with interns and I don't have to be afraid that those interns are going to get themselves into positions where, they're going to get hurt. Whereas I've been around other animals and that hasn't been the case. You know, we've watched animals run into gate panels and try to, go up over the tops of those in ways that you just go, I'm choosing the ones that don't have quite as much of a panic button, you know?
Yeah, and this seems to be uniform. So, circumstances that are could be a little alarming to most animals. And the temperament was true no matter which herd we were in.
Right.
These animals are easy to manage, I'm assuming,
right? Right, yeah, absolutely. And that's part of the delight of it, we move our animals in the summer when the grass is flush or spring, summer, and fall to pasture on a daily basis. And we call them and they come. They want to be engaged. Now, that's system. Other cattle are like that too. But when you walk out into a herd that hasn't seen you for a while, they're the same. These animals they're not running to the corners. Kelly Heaton from Arizona spoke at a Devon event not too long ago, and he said, like in Arizona, there's cattle on hundreds of thousands of acres, and he said they'll track their cattle to find them on horseback. And when they get to them in like these canyons, the cattle look at them like, hey, where have you been? Like, rather than like, oh, who are you? And take off, they like want to be connected with. And that, our cattle are that way too. We're super thankful for that. I can't imagine doing a nonprofit organization that designs experiences with people engaging the animals and them being different than that. I don't think it would work as well for us.
Now, you are stop on the tour for the Devon Congress, the 2024 in April. This is an amazing thing. We're really hoping we're going to be able to hit this one, because you just don't hear about, I think on some tours you've had 60 people on them, but the Devon breeders from around the world come to meet every, how many years?
I think it's every 4 years, but COVID might have thrown that off a year.
So. Yeah, but they come from Brazil and New Zealand and Australia and Canada and England and the United States. Forgive me if I've missed anyone out there, but Devon breeders, no matter where that diaspora occurred, you know, because they left England and they didn't just come to America, even though we're celebrating that this year for the 400-year anniversary.
Right.
Devons went everywhere.
All over.
Yes, right. They did. So I know that this is a great moment for everybody to come in and see on the ground examples of these animals. It's also a great opportunity for community. Have you been on these tours before?
Or? We had a mini tour stop here, and I think it was in 2018 or 2019. I can't remember the timing of that. But so we had a representation from around the world that came here for a stop, and that was awesome to connect. I've never actually gone on a tour like this. I've visited other farms, Bob Van Kirk's and Jeremy's I've been to, and AJ's, and a lot of others actually. But I'm excited to have people come. I mean, we learned so much from the eyes of the Brazilians about how they saw our herd. And the feedback from one of the guys from New Zealand is the reason why I have the bull that I have right now. He saw that bull as a 2-year-old at somebody else's farm, and he said, keep your eyes on that one. He's going to be a really good one.
It's almost like playing cards on the bus, right? Because everybody gets in the bus and goes awesome. From point A to point B. And I hear the pictures come out, and they either bring the photos or they'll get their phones out, and everybody go, ooh, look at that bull. Hey, I want some. So it's almost like a little trading card moment where it's not just the camaraderie, and it's not just seeing somebody else's. It's saying, hey, if I want stock or characteristics, I go here or there, right?
Right. Yeah, and I'm learning that. I mean, it's the feedback I received at that last mini tour was my herd was too feminine. I needed more masculinity in it. Like, I had really good cows, mama cows, but my bulls and my steers just didn't display the masculinity that I should have that would bring out the expression of them. So I bought another bull then, and now I'm a couple years down the road, and we've made some awesome changes as a result of that. That's my plug for the community of the Red Devon USA membership or the association is that it's a community, and it's like we feed each other. It's so rich, and I mean, it's playful. We banter with one another. We enjoy time together, and it's not really competitive. It's competitive in the sense of like, I want to do better than my brother. You know what I mean? Like, I have two younger brothers, and that's competitive, but we love each other. We take care of each other. And it's the same in the Devon community. Like, I go to Bob Van Kirk's herd, and I see cattle, and I'm like, dang, you're doing well with that. I want to improve mine, and how can I get there? And he raises the bar for me. And then we have new breeders come along that say, you know, I don't really know much. Well, that's where I was. Even last week, but I was, you know, 10 years ago, I was there even more so, and I didn't know much, and I had somebody put his arm around me and say, I'll teach you all this stuff.
That is one of the single biggest things that I can think of is a real advantage, and I know there's quite a few organizations that don't know that. The American Milking Devon Cattle Association does that too.
Right.
It's sort of a mentorship in
that's
a way.
Right.
And there is quite a bit of that rivalry you were talking about. It's a friendly rivalry, and I like that because I think that recognizes a little bit of the competition. But I'm here for you if you need me,
right.
You know.
Right.
But it's kind of you guys all tease each other, and it. I mean, life is pretty serious as it is. You might as well grab your little moments of glee while you can, right? And I'm sure that goes on the bus as they go around.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yes, but it is a really it seems like a community, and I'm very curious if that translate to the overseas bunch and if they have that same feeling.
Absolutely. We did a video series with Jerry Yang and Vic Edwards, and Vic's in Australia. where we would, every Tuesday, we'd get together and we'd talk about these bulls, a handful of bulls that impacted the U.S., herd and impacted the Australian herd or went other places around the world. Those conversations were so rich. And to hear Vic and Jerry, who are like years and years and years of experience, just provide feedback and then ask questions. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Tell me about what happened to that bull and what's the dam from that one and what was she like? And, did you ever have udder problems out of those? And I mean, it was just like, and so the World Devon Congress brings a lot of different perspectives together to display that. And they get to come here and see my herd and give me that feedback.
Yes, they
awesome.
Do. We were kind of smiling at this, saying if we did get on the bus, I said, Rick, how much work that's going to be, because we're going to want to start before breakfast and in the because there's all these little conversations that go on all throughout the day on every seat in the bus. You might spend a couple minutes, snoozing or looking at your stuff or answering. But other than that, you're kind of like, hey, that gal in seat 29, I need to talk to her because, boy, she had that little blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And it's both the people that are heavily into the technicalities of breeding Devons and also that camaraderie that we're trying to come up with a name that describes it best, the Devon widow or widower or the other half of the partnership that sort of is there sometimes because they love the breed and they're just as involved as their other half, and sometimes because, boy, you know what? I'm here along, and we can understand the joys and pains of being married to somebody that loves Devons, right? Because there seems to be this rabid loyalty amongst all of you to the Devon breed.
Yeah, absolutely that. And it's fun, like, you bring up the Devon widow. Like, my wife is one of them. my kids say this is my cowmunity. This is, at one point I was the president of the cows to them, which is funny. Now Jeremy's the president of the cows, But, it's they're thankful that, we love the animals that we're engaged with. They're thankful that the animals they're beautiful to watch, but so are other cattle. They're good to eat. The byproducts of those are amazing, and our the health that we get to provide for our community through selling Devon beef that are raised on grass, that are finished on grass, is something we're excited about and thankful for. And they're also thankful that they can come along and work cattle with me. They don't need to be experts, or I can just kind of help them along. And Devons are pliable like that. So, yeah. So when we move cattle across this busy highway out here from one pasture to another, we stop traffic. And I'll have my kids and my wife and everybody else from the community helping with that journey. And it's a fun day. They don't want to do that all the time. They're cool that I do it all the time.
They're probably also very grateful for docility in the cattle when you
yes,
do that.
Absolutely.
The whole community starts to appreciate your cattle.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, one of the things that I find both lovely and sad is that the host farms are willing to do this particular thing, because I know it's not cheap to have a lot of people on your farm, right? Because you might have anywhere between 30 and 100 people here. You really don't know how many are going to be here for this stop. And I understand that many people get a little bite to eat or something. Do you have any plans for that or what they might hear or see while they're here?
Yeah, so we are going to do a meal here. We're going to do a tour of our farm. So we do not just cattle. We'll do pasture poultry. We have grass-fed sheep, too. So people will get to see a multi-species enterprise, which is neat. I'm thankful for the opportunity to show that and what it displays. But then AJ's coming and we're going to do a different kind of a meal than probably they've had around the tour. We'll do some chicken with beef, and AJ's going to work his magic as a caterer and make that happen.
Ask for the bacon, because we went to AJ's yesterday. Between pickle bologna and the beef bacon he's got going, oh my land.
Beef bacon
is pretty good at what he does.
A little, at this point what we're shooting for is a chicken breast sandwich wrapped with beef bacon. But we're also going to do some of AJ's jerky. That'll be, I think we're going to do like a jerky sampler, like a jerky bar.
A jerky bar?
Yeah, would be kind of
now
fun.
I really want to be on the bus.
I know, right? So, and I mean, the cool thing about this is if you start in Florida, it's going to be different by the time you get up here. Like each place along the way, the Tranthams, the Walkers, Susan Simmons Farm down, all the way down in Florida at Monticello. Like those are going to be awesome stops with a lot of different flavor, you know?
Yeah, I will. I know that, we've been all over the country in the last 10 years or so speaking to farmers. You're never going to eat so well as you do on a farm because hospitality is fantastic. But we have a whole new level of, I can't go on Devon tours very often because the hospitality is wonderful and we eat like nobody's business. I mean, this has been one of those trips. I can't do this. I have to buy a whole new set of clothes after this trip. Right. Yeah. I mean, the food is really something else. So Pennsylvania has quite a bit of farming. You've got AJ and Bob that we visited, and then Virginia for somebody that might not be so familiar. Virginia's right down the road, and that's obviously I think that's one of the big stops is the Lakota stop.
Yeah, there'll be a couple days at Lakota and then visit to Thistle Hill right up the road from Lakota. And I think that's all in Virginia. Just south, there'll be a stop in North Carolina and one in South Carolina and Florida. One in Georgia, there'll be another stop there. Then the tour comes from Pennsylvania and comes to Ohio and goes to Central Ohio to see Mark Reed's farm, and then comes here to visit us, and then off to New York State where they see a Dairy Devon herd.
That's the Freers?
That will be awesome.
We've been there. That's a real treat.
I'm excited about that one. That's going to be a really good one for us to see.
And then head across to New Paltz, I think, I want to say.
Then to Full Moon Farm over at Paul Colucci's in New Paltz, and then up to Plymouth for the big event.
You get to. We've been to the Plymouth Patuxent Museum over there, Plantation. I spoke with Tom Begley, and he's very excited about this whole idea of the celebration. You can see the harbor right there. You see the water, and if you want to go visit a copy of the Mayflower, you can. It's down there on the docks. But it's for people who say, well, you know, how many Devons can I see? Right? It's not that. I mean, we're in a. You basically are seeing. You don't get to see the desert on this one, but you do get quite a spread. I mean, Florida is very different from the Carolinas, which is different from Pennsylvania, which is different from Connecticut or New York. I can see how people from Brazil, you know, if they're from one of the more tropical regions, might say, hey, how are they doing Devons in Florida? Because that's a little closer to me.
Right.
But this is a very flexible breed, and it's got a lot of elasticity in its tolerances, correct? You have breeders in Montana.
I mean, that's why they were brought, I think, to North America, was for their adaptability. I mean, they originally were, you know, milk, meat, and work, and they survived and thrived here, and it was all new forages, you know, and so you see that up and down the coast and east to west and around the world. Like the Devon cattle in Australia have been really struggling because of the drought, struggling but still thriving, you know? Then you go to New Zealand where it's very fertile and lush, and they're doing great there too and growing well. And then from England, and I mean, they're adaptable, and that's going to be the case all over the country. You started out by talking about C.S. Lewis and the lamppost, and like good stories teach us about the better stories, the best stories.
And what the stories can be if we choose to make those decisions.
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
So when we experience them, it points to a greater story. You know, we go, hey, I'm part of something that's way bigger than me.
I'm so glad you're on the board of directors.
Oh,
I bet you Red Devon thinks so too.
I hope so. Most of the time, it's just a pain. Because I'm the guy that says, hey, we got to put this on Google Drive, and nobody else gets that.
Well, now I'm going to have you take me out and show me your cattle so I can get that on film so the next guy on the board can say, oh, those cattle, I don't know if you want to go this way. That's not so good as blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. No. I won't show you the best because I don't want them to be jealous.
Thank you.
Appreciate the questions.
Mm-hmm.
If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. This is how we keep going. And please ask your friends to join us. Please also feel free to post any comments or questions to our social media sites. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook under Backyard Green Films. Thanks again for listening.
We'd like to thank Steve for joining us today. And if you'd like to find out more information about his farm and mission, please visit lampostfarm.com. We'll see you next time with another adventure. You have been listening to Agriculture with your host, Alara Bowman. Please tune in for more upcoming episodes of Our Travels. I'm Rick Bowman, your behind-the-scenes editor. Until next time. This has been a presentation of Backyard Green Films Productions. All rights reserved. Copyright 2024.